Okay, so hopefully no one's tired of hearing about mineral physics, but I thought this would be a good place to present just very, very briefly some of the work that I've done and been doing, and trying to tie it in to a very collaborative effort in terms of all the fields that are represented here. And what I would like to argue, although Dave gave a very optimistic view, and I would like to share the optimistic view of how the field of high-pressure mineral physics is going, he did forget or neglect to mention that one of the one of these very difficult things to do, and that hasn't really been done a lot, is looking at real compositions, real rocks, and Dion also mentioned that this is something that we were lacking. And so in the sense that Dion mentioned about, you know, whether you mix phases and then do an equation of state, or you do an equation of state and then you mix the phases and then you compare it to the Earth, I'll argue that as he has argued, this does make a difference. And so here, just to kind of bring the, you know, the chemistry into this and what a real rock looks like, this is just a thin section of a garnet larsolite, and so this is a peridotite that's come from the upper mantle, a sample, if you will, of an upper mantle. And not this particular sample, but a sample like this, I've done high pressure, high temperature experiments on. And basically, this is what the sample it was. So it's an olivine and pyroxenes and some garnet. And so the test was, okay, we have an upper mantle sample. Now what happens when we take that upper mantle sample to the conditions of the lower mantle and then look at the physical properties, namely the density and the bulk modulus? What is that? How does that compare to the Earth, namely the Earth as we know it by seismology, prime? So skipping to really all the experiments are done and so forth, at high pressures, and high temperatures, what we make out of that assemblage of olivine, pyroxenes, and garnet is an assemblage of the three lower mantle phases that we all know and love. We've got our perovskite, which seems like goes to post-perovskite at very high pressures, and as well as another, the calcium perovskite, and then we have a magnesium wustite. Okay? And it kind of breaks down in those ratios, and you have a distribution of iron and aluminum, and all of the other, you know, sort of minor elements that distribute themselves among those phases. Okay, well, so you can take that and you can compare it to the lower mantle, and what I show here is percent density difference along the y-axis versus pressure, so 25 GPa, just about the top of the lower mantle, down to 125 GPa, or just above the D double prime region, and where this post-perovskite phase may become important. Okay, and in color, we see in the cold colors is 1,000 Kelvin down to 3,000 Kelvin. These are isotherms. Okay, so we have this rock and what the density of this rock looks like as you go up in pressure, depending on a particular temperature. Now this is, again, this is percent density difference with respect to prem. So if a line lies at zero, that would mean that it agrees with prem absolutely. Okay. But as you can see, so at 2,000 Kelvin, I apologize for the color, 2,000 Kelvin should be in green, and you'll see that there's both a solid and a dashed line, which are two different thermal models. But what you see is you see a density offset, and what you find is that this peridotite is actually less dense than what prem would predict. Okay, and to actually match prem, you would need a lower temperature, 1500 Kelvin, to actually match prem best. But we know 1500 Kelvin is just much too low of a temperature to describe the lower mantle, because we have lavas that are that hot.
You take your mode of the experiment and then use available data to calculate the density between the phases.
We measure the density, we measure the volume at high pressure.
In order to get it up to high pressure and temperature,
So, okay, so we measure the equation of state for each of the phases in this assemblage all at the same time. And the equation of state was measured at 300 Kelvin. And the temperature, which these are two different models, are based on the thermal expansion, if you will, of two different types of models for thermal expansion. But either way, and these are n number, these are n number models.
You calculated up those temperatures using the properties of the individual phases that are in your assumption.
Yes. You can actually do these kinds of experiments also at high temperature, high pressure, at the same time with laser heating, as Dave was mentioning earlier. But because it's such complicated, the diffraction patterns, and I'll show one of a similar type of material, are really messy, and so it's actually quite difficult to do this. But you can do this kind of experiments.
This is an isothermal calculation.
This is an isothermal calculation. So 2,000 degrees, for instance, the green would be 2,000 degrees all the way throughout this pressure range. Okay. So what I was trying to say is that, you know, given reasonable mantle temperatures, you have a systematic offset for PREM, okay, of order 1 to 2%. Okay, so one can now take sort of their empirical experience now with these kind of assemblages, and you can then try and model other type of primitive compositions. Okay, and so these are some just compositions that we tried, and here again, this is percent density difference, same axis versus pressure, and the very high ones, so the ones that are much more dense than PREM, are a solar composition, a chondritic composition, and these all make sense because even though we think the Earth may be made up of chondrites, for instance, from those chondrites we also have to pull out a core, and so these include cores, so they're much more dense. And then we have a number of other type primitive compositions, kamadiites, various primitive mantle compositions, and so forth. And I'll go ahead and zoom in on this portion where we're looking for, you know, little difference from PREM, from seismology. And so these are all at 2,000 Kelvin isotherms. Okay, for reference, this purple dashed line is the experiments that I showed earlier at 2,000 Kelvin. And what you see is that, as we showed in the previous slide, that this peridotite is, again, offset from PREM, and that it looks like these models, a kamadiite, primitive mantle, a chondritic mantle, a primitive larsolite, might better match the density as given by PREM. So we would like to test other types of primitive compositions because we see that these primitive compositions seem to match better. And so Ed Stolper last year gave a talk at Marconi, and he was talking about these peroxenite veins in the mantle. And so I decided, okay, well, what does this peroxenite look like? And could this be a better match for the mantle? Since this peridotite wasn't a very, very good match. And so I went ahead and asked Mark Hirschman for a sample and have been doing experiments on this. But to test, these kinds of predictions of, does a more primitive type of rock better match what the seismological observations are? And so this is just very briefly what chemically these assemblages look like, and in comparison to PREM. So PREM is the middle column. BN35 was the peridotite that I showed earlier, and this is the peroxenite. And so what you can see, and I'll just highlight the main differences in composition, and I'll stress that these are, and I'll hope to show to you that these compositions actually make quite a big difference. You'll see that they differ quite a lot in aluminum. So your peroxenite has much more aluminum, much less magnesium, and much more calcium. Okay.
Why do you put it farther away from?
Yeah, that was my question too.
Testing the standard model of upper mantle, lower mantle, whole mantle convection. Pyrolite upper mantle seems to match them. And so this BN35 is actually quite a good analog to pyrolite if you look at the chemistry. It's not exactly, but that's the test. But the upper mantle is very messy, so. Okay. So you can now try and predict, given the chemistry, the bulk chemistry of the rock, try and predict what kind of assemblage you would make. And so I can dumbly do this very easily. Okay. Well, given that peroxide composition that I showed earlier, I would predict that we'd have, again, three phases, three lower mantle phases, two perovskites, and an oxide, magnesium woodstite. And because there was a lot more calcium in this particular phase, or this particular assemblage, then I would assume that you'd have a lot more calcium peroxide. It's very simple, nothing magic about this. Yeah.
Orthorhombic peroxide in this case has a lower Mg to Fe ratio than it did in the other one.
Yes.
But the magnesium woodstite is the same.
This is just a prediction, and I'll show you that this prediction is wrong. So you run the experiment, and this is a diffraction pattern at 32 GPa at room temperature. Okay, and there's a lot of diffraction lines here and a lot of colored lines here. And the colored lines, these dark blue ones correspond to an orthorhombic perovskite. The light blue ones correspond to a calcium perovskite. And let's see. And then there's a bunch of other lines. You don't see magnesium woodstite lines, which I predicted we would see. You don't actually see those. But you do see stishovite here as shown in red. And then you see a whole bunch of stuff in the noise. And that I attribute to, those have also been seen in other type of messy rock samples, and that's a sodium aluminum rich phase. So I can take a diffraction pattern like this and say, okay, well, obviously my predictions weren't right. Okay, I don't see any magnesium woodstite, and I see stishovite and something else, something with some minor elements in it. So this isn't very, this is a little disconcerting though, because you think you actually know something and then you find out you don't. Well, you can take that even further and try and do some chemical analysis on this. And here I show, this is an SEM image of our quenched peroxide. And here's a scale bar for 2 microns. And you can see very easily that our sample grain sizes, as Dion mentioned, are very small. They're submicron. I wouldn't say that they're 10 nanometers, but they're certainly very small. Okay. And so the problem with something like this, and where we want to go and try and use a focus ion beam and do TEM analysis, that would be the way to go. But at the time, this is what I have, right? This is what I have access to. So I can do kind of an average chemical analysis of the quenched sample. And what I find when doing that, and I warn you that these are just averages because you're going to be averaging over many grains, because your beam size for your SEM is, order 5 microns. If I've got submicron grain sizes in there, it not only samples the surface, but also a volume. So you can have, say, hundreds of grains being sampled. But if you say, okay, fine, that's best as we can do given that particular technology, what you actually find is that you get 2 perovskites in about the same ratio as you expected before, but you also get a lot of stishovite. And so instead of having a magnesium woodstite oxide, you actually have a bunch of stishovite in there, a silica. So this particular assemblage is as we could have seen by the previous chemistry table, is very high in silica. And I don't actually know if I put the next slide. Actually, so what it works out to be, and I still have very little data on this particular assemblage, not enough to do a full equation of state. However, from what I have, from the limited data that I do have, what I actually find is that this particular assemblage would actually be more dense than Prem by about 3 to 4%, whereas the prototype was less dense by 1 to 2%. This is actually more dense. Okay, so I just put that out as kind of something to think about. And then what I would like to argue, though, is that, yeah, composition does really matter. But then, you know, to kind of highlight the post-perovskite phase transition that may be happening, we need to really pin down what iron and aluminum, which do go into the perovskite phase, due to that phase boundary. And then as well as look at all the other kind of undesirables that may be down in the D double prime range and in the core in terms of partitioning. So, talk to Beth.
One model for the lower mantle is that it's the refractory residue after you accrete the earth at high temperature and strip out the salt and magma oceans and things. So the refractory lower mantle would then have less aluminum and calcium and sodium than perhaps a natural perovskite. You know, I can't remember from your previous slides whether the calcium perovskite is denser and the aluminum strain increases the density of your compound.
So the aluminum, I assume...
If you took the aluminum and the calcium out of your rock, what would it do with that?
So the calcium, the calcium perovskite is always more dense than just a regular N member magnesium perovskite.
Okay, so if you took that out of your mix, you would get closer to Prim.
Yes, that's, barring anything else, different, that's what I would expect.
And the aluminum?
The aluminum tends to decrease the density. Goes into the magnesium perovskite. And so what aluminum does is it inflates the volume. And it's still questionable whether or not the aluminum increases or decreases the bulk modulus. I say it would increase, but there are lots of people who say I wouldn't.
The fact that you don't see spectral lines for magnesium state, does this at 65 pH? State does not form as a result of the phase transformation, or what does it mean?
I think what it means for the perovskite is that it's silicon saturated. So there's not actually enough magnesium to go around to make it a perovskite. Because that wasn't the case in the prototype or pyrolyte model.
If you want to check whether you can really do a chemical balance, the perovskite, it's pretty much going to be around the PSMFA, basically. Everything has R2 over 3. Right now, it's true that the composition isn't going to be right on there, and it's a little silica excessive, and it has distributed a little silica 4, so that makes you a woodside. But the 17% silica, it doesn't sound like it's going to add up right, unless there's some other phase, but there's also there in tens of percent that are compensating for it to get it back onto the filling. And so this, you want to check that it adds up.
You're absolutely right. And when I say those average sort of SEM results, I have not, I do see the diffraction, sodium, aluminum, silicate type phase. And I have not taken that into account.
But there has to be a lot of silicate 4 phase. On the proper join. And this is the same composition that Hirschman worked on. You know, that thing had a little bit of silica deficiency. When the partial melts of that had very little silica because it fell slightly on the silica 4 side. I just want to make sure that it was a state of the composition.
Lars and I ran primary ocean crust last week in this thermal program. And so it's sort of a documented composition. So it was designed to look at average ocean crust. And it came out almost exactly like your pure black. There's some calcium perovskite, some specialized, and the like, and the almost in those things.
send the first propane distillery for the next.
Yeah, I haven't actually tested on Lars's program yet, because I haven't gotten it to run on my machine, but I will play with that. And it's actually kind of a powerful tool, because it can kind of predict these things. Although I hedge a bit, because as I showed that, you know, my intuition, the prediction that I first made, you know, given my bias of I know what the three lower mantle phases are, was wrong. And so I think that's something that we should keep in mind when, you know, trying to make chemical models of the Earth as well, because I think we need data to constrain it, as well as sort of putting together sort of n member materials and mixing those equations of state after the fact, rather than looking at looking at rocks in situ. Yes, I guess that's kind of the selling point that I wanted. And I also wanted to mention that perovskite, as Don showed, is a completely generic term that also spans across a wide range of alumina versus MgO and silica even. So this is a very, kind of generic term, but each of those, the abundances of each of those oxides, I would argue, is very important.
One more question. In plotting the difference in respect to trend, all your predictions have a specific curvature, which was sort of sudden, low, and ended up high.
I think that's because I have an easy isotherm, whereas the real Earth is hungry to keep that. Maybe I wanted you to get that there was an offset.
Yeah.
The curve is not, I wouldn't put too much into that.
Correcting to an adiabat would certainly eliminate a lot of that curvature, although I got the impression it would not eliminate all of it.
No,
I suppose
probably
it depends
not.
What you assume for gamma. But
yeah.
Looked as though there might be a problem still. Of course, we don't know what the USA is bad.
Sure.
But,
prime is good for, whole mantle or mid-mantle type of, averaging over that.
Yeah.
But at the boundaries, that's where it's less good. So.
What I'm getting at, of course, is that Pram doesn't, whatever you mean by Pram, doesn't have to be a uniform composition thing anyway. So if one started with the hypothesis that you had a uniform composition lower mantle and could never fit it, and if you believe Pram, then that would be an argument that the lower mantle is not homogeneous with pipe.
Any correspondence between pram-like and pram is purely coincidental.
Many studies that say pyrolite and pram match.
Well, we should mail Catherine with another,
to his grave.
Yeah, we should mail another reward.
Oh,
because he guessed the average composition of the Earth exactly by mixing together. What did he mix together? Hartsburgite and some random Hawaiian basalt.
How did you treat? Obviously, you have a pressure dependent. Coefficient thermal expansion rate, some assumption. I calculated your coefficient thermal expansion at the bottom of your plot was about 25 times 10 minus 6.
At the bottom it's something like 2 times 10 to the
minus. Yeah, and it looked to me like it was a little bit, or quite a bit higher than people are getting for a prospect. And had an issue with that.
That's why I showed actually those two models. So one is kind of a low thermal expansion model, which would and the other was sort of what we call standard, although one could certainly argue that it's high. But you see actually at the base of the mantle they converge. So even though they make a lot of big difference, pressure makes a big effect, as you can appreciate, pressure makes a big effect on thermal expansion.
But factor 2 in here.
But at pressure, your thermal expansion doesn't matter as much. Your pressure matters.
Yeah. No,
so actually, you see that as a
pressure. So I wonder what kind of theory you're using.
It's a Neimanizing theory.
by. I can show you the actual table.
Okay, that's good.
Doesn't look that bad. It's more than a factor of two. At least that's what I'm reading. Mm-hmm.
6% out of 3.
If you believe this big one, yeah.
In your proximate experiment, you have a large amount of toxins in your perovskite. Do you assume that it's going to be pure, or?
I assume that it's going to be pure, and it may not. Actually, we know that aluminum goes into calcium perovskite. I say that it's calcium perovskite because when you stuff enough aluminum into calcium perovskite, it changes the structure. And so I would expect different diffraction lines. And one could definitely argue, like, well, you've got a forest of lines in there. How would you be able to tell? So first cut, certainly. I assume that it's just a calcium.
You have to also consider the possibility of iron substitution that could increase
symmetry. I think even so, the amount of total, I mean, just the bulk composition is going to, that just that mass, that elemental mass, is going to, dictate what your density is. So the fact that we have more calcium and more iron in the peroxenite versus the pyrolite or the peridotite, already I can easily believe that those are going to be, that it's going to be more dense. So we can play games about where you put the iron and so forth, but I think in terms of the whole rock density, it's not going to matter.
Yeah, but if you substitute ions, you change volume too, right?
But we measure the volume. So you can measure the volume. If you measure the volume all of the phases, you have your volume and you have your total mass. So I think you can still pull out the density. Even if you kind of, waffle between where the iron goes and where the aluminum goes, the whole rock density is not going to change very much.
And the real concern I have is you have 17% of species life. In your experiment, was only 32 GPA.
32.
Yeah. Yes, 32 GPA. There are a number of reports out there that even if you start with perfect one-to-one ratio of MGSI3, you tend to see formation of some species bites if you do an experiment between 85 and 30 GPA range. You don't quite understand why that is the case, but you tend to see formation of species by beginning to start with one ratio of MGSI3, and that could be due to several of the non-equilibrium things in your experiment. So I think you probably need to go.
Oh, agreed.
Beyond
that. Agreed. This is not a close story.
Yeah.
I would argue though that if I see species by, I should see MGO. If I do see sort of the breakdown, I would see MGO, and I don't.
Well, I'm not talking about the breakdown. Yes. Well, people sell MGO in those kind of experiments, so it's probably a defect in the cross that was a tissue type. So I wonder if the observation of tissue type may be the same thing.
I have to check that. The highest pressures I've gone in this particular sample is just 40 GPA. And so there's a long way to go to map out the mantle. Soon, one of these days, I'll get some game time so we can do this. Yeah.
I'm interested, Karen. How many of those lines are you doing?
Let's see. Okay. So I haven't done a refill on this. This is still new, so I haven't actually done much. So the main magnesium silicate perovskite is in the dark blue, okay? So the triplet, which is under here, as well as these are sort of the main lines. So there's actually quite a lot to determine your perovskite volumes. Your calcium perovskite, it's cubic or tetragonal. There's a slight splitting of one of the lines. But I have three lines here that I can determine the volume with. Let's see, I do have, unfortunately in this particular diffraction pattern, I mean, this is kind of an embarrassing diffraction pattern, it's not very nice.
I have gold on the back of my diamond, and those are these intense peaks. That's gold. Let's see. The Sishovite is in red, and you'll see that from a, you know, kind of a generic Sishovite equation of state, it doesn't quite fit. Something could be happening with the Sishovite. Okay, but there, those are with the red. And a lot of the other bumps and wiggles, it's messy. It's messy. But most of them can be attributed to this NAL phase, this kind of pseudo-lumen rich phase that has been seen in sort of basalt kinds of experiments. That's what you would expect given. The Sishovite ones. Oh, no. The Sishovite ones, you'll notice they're all the same height.
Yeah.
That's given my. That's just mean. That's just generic. That's completely random. That's just so I could see them. But in terms of the height of the lines, if you had a pure just MG cross sky diffraction pattern, the lines should match the heights of the blue lines, the dark blue lines. But remember, this is a mixture. So your intensity of diffraction lines also depends on the abundance of that particular coverage. So your perovskite lines, you would expect, your perovskite lines are going to be your most intense because that's the most abundant phase. But so for the Sishovite, they're actually all the same size, but I made them that way. This is not supposed to be a figure that I'm supposed to show to you. This is a working figure for me to identify things. Those are just for
identification. Places where you predict it. The red lines. I mean, there's
the red lines
in the spectrum.
I would agree with that. That it's slightly offset from.
Well, that one is offset, but then you have.
And then you have this one, which also may be offset.
Or you think that one of these peaks actually is. Corresponds to the red line.
I guess
you can play that game. You
could. It's much smaller.
Oh, you don't expect that these peaks would be the same size.
Okay.
Not at all. The size of the red peaks are for my eyes only, and everybody else in this room apparently.
Can you remind me whether the bulk sound velocity of primitive mental models do a better job than your bulk sound.
I don't actually have a plot of the bulk sound. I can calculate square root of k and rho. I actually haven't done that. But thank you for reminding me. You can do that. I mean, you can certainly do that. And you can certainly try and figure out what the modes would look like given different lower mantle assemblages, and that's something that a student at Barba's and I were working on a few years ago and kind of dropped, but you can certainly play those games and see what, you know, changing the lower mantle and, you know, figuring out what its bulk sound velocities are and making, you know, certain assumptions about the shear modulus so you can figure out the other velocities, what modes you would expect giving, you know, by varying the lower mantle.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Is this the one? No, I think this. I didn't do anything. Oh. Is there the one up here?
No.
Okay, we're good. Give an introduction. My name is Christine. I'm a student of Guy Masters, and I'm about to finish, hopefully sooner than later.
and I've been working on global tomography, obviously, and I wanted to show you a few things. My main interest is the, well, the whole globe, but I think the transition zone is a pretty interesting place for obvious reasons, because you can learn, start combining seismology with actual physical properties of the mantle that we're interested in. So, this is just some snippets of a talk I gave earlier this year, and not too many details. I'm a full disclosure seismologist, so I always start with the resolution test, okay? So the purpose of this slide was to show how the smearing happens in the transition zone, and I've been working on combining velocity models with discontinuity topography.
What data?
I'm inverting SS precursor data for the topography and combining that with the body of the surface waves for the velocity anomaly. And the surface waves are what is doing smearing here, and the surface wave sensitivity decreases with depth. So if you have, say, a structure here, you smear more up here and down there. One of the interesting things about that is, in a couple slides I'll show you that we see a slab signature here at the 410 and at the 660, and I don't believe that it's just due to smearing, because I think if you have a couple layers in here, it's going to smear some more this way. I think that we can actually resolve what's going on around the 400 kilometers depth, and that there's not much leakage from topography to velocity.
Did you try to look at the resolution for other than checkerboard, for the sharp structures?
Sharp structures in the upper mantle?
Yeah, the continent ocean.
No, I didn't try like a continent ocean. And then this is just to show that the transition zone, the precursor data, doesn't smear into the velocities. And this is just, didn't want to concentrate on the velocity model, but here it is, and I'll zoom in on the upper mantle. And this is just comparing it to velocity-only inversions. Here's topography. The thing we know best is the transition zone width, because these things, we're taking the precursors to SS. If you take the difference between the 410 and the 660, then you get the transition zone width. And that doesn't depend on upper mantle structure at all. So that's their best constraint, is this transition zone width. And then we have the 410 topography, so this is plus minus 17 kilometers here. So the blues are depressions and the reds are rises in the topography. And you can kind of see, you know, some things you expect. Oh, we're in the subduction zone, so rise in the 410, depression in the 660. And that's kind of nice, but there's a lot of areas where it doesn't quite work. Here's where our topography here's the coverage map, and you can see that the coverage that dictates where you have the highest errors. So green means we only have an error of around 2 kilometers, and the oranges are more around 6 or 7.
What do you mean by error? Is it random, or is it biased in one direction?
Oh, this is putting in a Monte Carlo type method. So you put in random error into the data, and then take about 100 models or so. And then this is the difference in the models that come out. Okay, so what I'm trying to do is compare the block, the transition zone, the discontinuity structure here, so the 410, 660, with their corresponding velocity anomalies. So that was just right above the 400, and that was just above the 660. So here's some correlation plots of the 410, the 660, transition zone versus the velocity model. And you see that we kind of get, except in the transition zone, we don't correlate well at degree one, which is a bit odd. And the correlations are okay, but they're not great. And then it gets really interesting when you convert the velocity anomalies. You assume the Clapeyron slope, and you take density and assume temperature differential, and compute the predicted topography, and compare that to the observed topography. And here's what comes out of the model, and here's what comes out of the prediction from the velocities. And there, at 400, 410, there's hardly any correlation at all. 660, you get the slab, but not much else. In transition zone, you get kind of degrees 2 or 3, but not a whole lot else. So I just want to bring up the fact that I think that seismology has a long way to go in kind of nailing down the parameters of the transition zone. And these global models have the problem, Guy talked about it last week, that the surface waves, as I said earlier, start petering out when you get in the transition zone. And in the global models, we don't pick waves that turn in the transition zone because of the complications of matriculation. So it's one of the areas where we have the worst coverage, but it's one of the areas that is most interesting. So I think that there's a lot of work to be done in combining more regional studies like converted phases, sort of receiver functions, as well as the studies that look at regional triplications of the transition zone, and trying to really nail down some of the parameters that we talk about in the middle of mineral physics and chemistry of what's going on down there. So I wanted to go today. It doesn't really tie in extremely well with what's been going on this afternoon, but I'm going to be gone for the next couple of days, so I want people to know what I'm interested in. So in the groups break off, anybody's interested in relating the seismology, the heterogeneities to physical parameters, let me know.
So you've got that up, that the transition zone with its color coding, so that the red would be upwelling areas.
Depends on which discontinuity you're on. So red for the 410 is depressed, which means I would indicate cold.
The width would be
Yes, the width would be upwelling, and the thin would be upwelling. It would be a cold. Well, thin would be warm, and thick would be cold.
You didn't mention overtime. I thought the way to look at others for some years
Yeah, they say they can get it better, and it does look a little bit better. It's a very delicate process in removing all those overtones, and so.
You can just do the waveform.
Okay.